So, welcome to this class on the future of innovation management. This class, we're going to challenge the image of how innovation happens that has been implicit to most of the readings that we've done so far. And we can refer to kind of the conventional image of how innovation happens in a number of different ways, and certainly the texts do that, right? You will see it referred to as Chandlerian or Schumpeterian in these texts, for instance. But what's shared across the different papers, despite the variance in terminology, is the idea that innovation conventionally has been something that organizations, and by that we mean mostly private companies, do through some kind of internal process where a dedicated department is tasked with doing what tends to be called R&D, right? Research and development. This sometimes gets called functional ambidexterity. We called it that in an earlier class. Can also be organized as structural ambidexterity, in which you have R&D happening in separate business units. But basically, you have this idea that there are units dedicated to doing development work, innovation work. You can have that work be more or less explorative. You can organize it in a number of different ways. But the idea, at its sort of banal nature, is that you hire a bunch of technical experts, and they then work on problems that are relevant to the company's innovation agenda. And they do that work mostly in isolation, not in the sense that they work in their own little cubicles. Sometimes they do, but not generally. They work in isolation from the rest of the organization, typically, at least formally. And the process may be more or less secret in order to either ensure that the company can patent whatever technology gets developed, assuming that it's first and has that first mover advantage, or they might do it secretly in order to keep the innovation a trade secret. This sometimes gets called a closed model of innovation, and it was, just to be clear, itself a pretty novel idea at a point in time where it constituted a major organizational innovation, right? So Edison's Menlo Park was founded in 1876, I believe, and it was the first real industrial R&D facility, right? This organizational innovation, debatably, was one of Edison's most important innovations, and he was involved, after all, in quite a few. As you would expect from something that works so well, or you would hope for something that works so well, the innovation diffused together with the advance of industrial capitalism and the rise of the modern corporation, as business historian Alfred Chandler has pointed out in his book called Scale and Scope. That's why it gets called a Chandlerian model, by the way. And it's pretty much the model that Schumpeter takes for granted in his later works, in which he sees, in contrast to his earlier work, large corporations as the driving force of innovation. In his view, the consumer, or rather the producer, is educating consumers to use technologies that producers develop. That's why it also gets called a Schumpeterian model. Irrespective of what you call it, this model of how innovation generally happens has been challenged by the emergence, like the empirical emergence, of various forms of open innovation processes. And in this class, we're going to look at a variety of open innovation processes, and we'll discuss what makes them tick. We'll look at some of the implications that they have for innovation management. I'm going to treat them as kind of falling on a spectrum of how central firms are to the innovation process. And first, we will look at a highly firm-centric conception of openness. And then towards the end, we'll look at how innovation happens without the involvement necessarily of formal business organizations. Before we get into the meat of this, you should know that a big part of why we're seeing this change away from a Schumpeterian or Chandlerian model and towards something more open, albeit in different ways, has to do with technology, with the internet coming to play an absolutely crucial role in reducing communication costs, right? This is a general purpose technology, is doing its thing, having far-reaching effects in the way that David made us alert to. Economists will tell you, and as may common experience, right, that reducing the cost of something makes it possible to do more of it. Whether it gets done depends on other things. And it has turned out, very much in Shane's spirit, that the reduced costs that the internet affords has allowed some organizations and individuals to recognize an opportunity to organize innovation in a new way. you could push the argument a bit further, and you could say that open forms of innovation, like the ones we're going to be talking about, represent sort of a disruptive innovation. Thinking back here to how Christensen talks about this, a disruptive innovation in how the organization of innovation happens, right? Recall that Schumpeter mentioned new ways of organizing, new social technologies for managing as an important part of creative destruction, and as important as new technological technologies. So whether such creative destruction, whether disruption will emerge is a topic for discussion. Scholars are quite divided, reasonable scholars are quite divided on how far-reaching open innovation will be. But nonetheless, that's kind of a theme that we can discuss in class. Right? Thus prefaced, let us turn to the papers. We'll be returning to the question of the transition from a Chandlerian model of innovation management to this new world, and what its implications are in the last text, the chapter by Altman et al. Also, be aware that I'm going to break up this podcast, as I usually do, so that you can kind of revisit the individual parts of it more easily. Right? We'll start off by talking about the market for technology. Then we'll move on to broadcast search. Then in the third installment, we'll talk about free innovation. And then finally, we'll talk about the chapter on innovation without information constraints. So first off, it's the paper Markets for Technology and Their Implications for Corporate Strategy by Ashish Arora, Andrea Fosfuri, and Alfonso Gambardella. So a market for technology, although the authors kind of hesitate a bit in defining it, refers to transactions, and I'm quoting now, right, transactions for the use, diffusion, and creation of technology, end of quote. So we are, just to unpack that a little bit, dealing with various efforts to buy and sell technologies as if they were goods, right? Technologies, of course, aren't goods. They are ideas, and ideas have a whole range of features that make them different from goods in important ways. On the one hand, superficially, they're perfectly tradable, right? A blueprint for a technology can, so to speak, be copied infinitely at virtually no cost. So it's easy to give away. On the other hand, technology and ideas often have a tacit component and a lot of context-specific features that make them very hard to transfer. A blueprint is only blueprint, right? You can copy it all you want, but it's not a working prototype. Also, asking someone to develop an idea for you is very different from getting them to build a physical product. That's what the authors are referring to when they talk about the difficulties of contracting around innovation, right? This, however, is a bit of an extended discussion, and suffice to say that for the moment, the economics of ideas are going to be something that's different from the economics of physical goods, and there have been kind of numerous developments in the technologies underpinning technology development and in how we think about the management of creative effort that goes some way towards reducing that distance. Reasonable people can debate how much. If you want to look more into it, I recommend the paper from 1994 called The Changing Technology of Technological Change. That's also by Ashish Arora and Alfonso Gambardella. And it's kind of a nice overview of some of these things. But nonetheless, markets for technology are about transactions of technology. Selling technology without selling products, necessarily. So most often, the actors in these markets are implicitly considered to be firms. Right? The image that you should have in your mind as you think about markets for technology is mainly firms of various sizes that either license technologies to each other, typically by allowing others to use technologies that have been patented and therefore cannot legally be used without permission. Or you can think of firms that engage in different forms of alliances such that they work together on developing an innovation. Sometimes the actors involved might be independent inventors. They might also be universities. Right? You can kind of think back to the empirical part of Shane's paper And you might remember that it looked at entrepreneurs trying to license a technology from the university, MIT. But the typical picture, the one that you should generally have in mind, is of firms interacting with each other, buying, selling, temporarily licensing technologies from each other's technology portfolios, or engaging in collaboration on specific development projects. Right. The authors make quite a point of this being a phenomenon that's growing, but also that it's something with a pretty long history. Right. We'll be returning to that issue for several of the papers for this class, because it turns out that many of them have sort of been around for a long time, but they've just picked up speed in recent decades for various reasons. In the case of markets for technology, the authors kind of point out that the model of trading technologies was probably an invention of the German chemical industry, and it was something that was rapidly adopted in the US. Different forms of unpaid exchange and informal joint development of technology has sort of been a feature of technological progress since at least the same time. You can also look at Allen's idea of collective invention, which was published in the Journal of Economic Behavior and Organization in 1983, and has been suggested to be a pretty common feature of engineering work. Also, Eric von Hippel, who we'll be returning to later today, has a paper from 1987 called Cooperation Between Rivals, published in Research Policy, that's dealing with kind of the informal side of joint technology development. But anyway, right, if we think about markets for technology in this relatively, as something that's relatively recent and ascendant, what's going on, right? Why and what's going to happen? At the very least, the authors claim markets for technology are going to enlarge the strategy space for both incumbent companies and for entrepreneurs, right? They're going to increase the amount of things that you want to attend to as you're thinking about company strategy, irrespective of whether you're a large company or an emerging small one. And as importantly, they can contribute, as in markets for technology can contribute, to changing the competitive dynamics of an industry, both increasing and decreasing the value of technologies to firms. And to kind of make that argument, the authors do something which I think is relatively clever. Basically, they describe a world without markets for technology, and then they use that as a jumping off point for talking about what is instead the case and what is generally and empirically the case. In a world without markets for technology, and I quote, "the immediate consequence is that the innovator must exploit the technology in-house. That is, in order to extract the value from the technology, it must be embodied in goods and services which are then sold." So in other words, in a world without trading of technologies, if you invent something, you have to be able to turn it into a whole product or a service and then bring that product to market if you want to profit from it. That means getting it produced and distributed, and that is not in any way a simple task, especially if it requires you to first invest in building up the productive capacity. You also have to be pretty confident that the market is large enough to generate returns on the order of letting you pay off the investment. So you can see why something like that means that large firms are going to be the primary innovators, right? Simply put, you need an organization to be in place if you want to profit from technology. That's going to put the strongest incentive to innovate on incumbents. They may not be particularly good at innovating, right? We kind of talked about Abernathy and March and Henderson and Clark a great deal. But nonetheless, if they are forced to do so, as per Schumpeter, they will do so. And in a situation where they're the only ones who stand to gain, they may well be the only ones who do it. But this class, as I kind of prefaced with, is all about change. And the world that is thus counterfactually described as one that's fading fast. So let's see what actually happens when you do have markets for technology and assuming that they function. Right? For entrepreneurs, suddenly it's going to make new strategies viable. Right? More specifically, entrepreneurial firms can now choose to specialize in technology development, and they can simply forego competing in product markets. If you have an idea for optimizing, I don't know, something like inventory management software, right? In a world without markets for technology, in order to benefit from that, you have to build a whole inventory management software business and acquire all, right? You have to build a business that's going to use that inventory management software and acquire all the assets that are necessary for that to work out. And then you have to compete with the incumbents in the industry that you choose to enter. Right. So in a world with markets for technology, you could just viably develop that idea. You could sell it to an incumbent, say SAP or some other software company, and you could let companies that haven't developed the particular invention that you are marketing benefit from it without having developed it. Right? If you have an idea for improving, I don't know, like insulin protection, don't even bother competing with Novo Nordisk, right? Just sell your technology to them. Right. So seen this way, markets for technology are going to imply that more innovations can be economically viably developed by entrepreneurs. And as the authors of the paper say, markets for technology may be critical to the very existence of high-tech startups. Right. As you may recall, I mentioned the book on entrepreneurial strategy by Scott Stern and Joshua Gans in an earlier lecture. And one of the four generic strategies that they suggest, namely what they call the intellectual property strategy, is basically completely based on the existence and functioning of markets for technology. Right? You can think of some examples of this, right? The Super Soaker, for instance, it's made by a toy company called Hasbro, but it's under license from its inventor, Lonnie Johnson, who's basically an inventor with more than 120 patents to his name, and he sells all of those inventions on the market for technology without ever developing them himself. This also means that entrepreneurial startups can avoid shifting to large-scale, exploitative, and specific forms, right? And they can avoid the perils of having to cross a chasm. They can just remain explorative and fluid and focus on innovating and then work only in the markets for technology. Right, so this is going to be a different path for organizations to take, and one which perhaps allows them to overcome the challenges associated with the productivity dilemma, because they never have to get into that. I'm sorry, there's an emergency outside my window. We will carry on. Okay. Now, just hold on for a second. Sorry about that. Sorry for the break. Turned out that it was nothing particularly serious, at least right outside the window. The ambulances and fire trucks went on down the street. Okay. Anyway, there's another way to think about the implications of this. Aurora and his colleagues mentioned that market, and I'm quoting now, markets for technology can undermine privileged access to technology that incumbent firms in an industry may enjoy because competitors and entrants may acquire the technology from alternative sources of supply in the market. At the industry level, markets for technology lower entry barriers, increase competition, and compress product life cycles. Right, so new entrants, in principle, are the entrepreneurs. And the lowering of entry barriers is what allow them to get into an industry. So it doesn't just mean that entrepreneurs can focus on exploring as technology developers. It also means that as technology users, they can focus potentially on exploiting, potentially just buying their technologies, the technologies that they need in the markets for technology, leapfrogging over a whole lot of product development that would be necessary in the absence of the opportunity to buy technologies in the market, right? So they can focus just on exploiting and getting really good at that rather than having to span both activities. Right. Now that kind of segues nicely into the effects for incumbents. Let's start with what it means for companies that are struggling to keep up with the rate of innovation in their industry. You could easily imagine this being the case for lots of organizations, especially large incumbent ones. As the authors put it, I'm going to quote now, for companies with lower in-house technological capabilities, the existence of external technology sources may be critical to enhance their ability to produce and sell more innovative goods. The astute reader, of course, would add to this that it's not just technological capabilities that matter, but also the organizational capabilities to leverage them, but that's an aside. What this means is that competition in an industry is going to be increased because the playing field gets leveled by the presence of markets for technology. If your internal R&D can't figure out how to design that new component that's going to be crucial to product functionality, well, you can now buy it, perhaps in the market for technology, and you can stay competitive, even lacking a well-functioning R&D unit. Right? Also, there are implications for the incumbents that are good at innovating. Right? Markets for technology allow them to use those technologies in new ways. Right? You can kind of use the technology for in-house exploitation if you think it contributes to your product's performance. Or you might think that you can earn additional what I call rents from the innovation by licensing it out to your competitors. Right? That might compromise your product's performance relative to your competitors and thus reduce your product profits, but it'll increase your revenue from licensing. And that suddenly forces you to think about what technologies are actually core to your competitive position and which ones are marginal. And the marginal ones might make a lot of sense to license out. It could also be a question of what technologies you believe you can, ambidextrously, successfully commercialize within your organization. If, for instance, structural ambidexterity is not an option for whatever reason, markets for technology may make networked ambidexterity an efficient option that, of course, has its own set of organizational challenges. Because innovation is uncertain and sometimes serendipitous, and because R&D workers sometimes do their own thing, like bootlegging, firms also sometimes develop solutions that turn out not to fit with their business, even as they try to have R&D be very focused on strategically relevant objectives. In that case, you can sell those innovations off instead of having them just go to waste and die, what you might call a death by file drawer. And Xerox is sort of the poster child for this, having developed a graphic user interface and a range of other technologies, but never really commercializing them. And also failing to recognize the value of the things that they developed. Right? You can, as a bit of a footnote, think about the underutilization of R&D as a strategically directed problem. Right? You can assume that firms recognize the value of what they've developed, but may forego using it if it does not fit with their strategic interests, the markets they're in, the customers they serve, etc. From that perspective, maybe the reason Xerox didn't utilize the graphic user interface for anything particular was that they were a copier company, and Xerox's R&D was just a little bit too explorative. It was going into directions that maybe weren't so necessary. You can also see it as a less enlightened process where firms simply fail to appreciate the opportunities afforded by their innovations. Maybe Steve Jobs, because of an alternative set of market insights, driven in part by his prior knowledge, recognized the value of the graphic user interface. And the price that Xerox negotiated, which was very limited, at least suggests that they didn't really see the value of what they were developing beyond its curiosity value. The existence of markets for technology, assuming, of course, that they work as efficient markets generally do, would actually be kind of a helpful way of discovering the value of technologies. Right? Assume that you could get enough people to help set a value on your technology, right? For instance, setting the value of the graphic user interface. What would happen in a well-functioning market is that you could actually use the price signal as an indicator of just how valuable your technology is to others. Now, that's not going to work particularly well in a thin market, which we can discuss in the class session, but in principle, you could use that as kind of finding out what your technology is worth. You can also think about markets for technology as opening up a combination of in-house exploitation and licensing out. As the authors mentioned, there may be markets in which you will exploit the technology yourself and others in which you do not, right? You can then assuming that this is contractually plausible, license the technology out for specific uses. You could use it either in particular geographies, say license something out only for use in South America, or only for particular industrial applications. Or you could use it as a means to create an industry standard or a dominant design by offering your technology cheaply. Right? We know kind of from Abernathy and Anderson and Tushman that the emergence of a dominant design is a pretty transformative event in an industry and potentially something that affords a considerable strategy advantage, right? And imagine that you develop a technology and then license it out for others to use, such that instead of competing with your competitors about what will be the dominant design, you collaborate with them on promoting your particular design. Then, of course, you might compete on other dimensions, but on a playing field that the technology developer has partially defined, right? So again, lots of new strategic opportunities. What this does, though, is that it brings about a need for firms to more actively think about their technologies as a portfolio, similarly to how investment banks might think about the stocks they own as a portfolio of positions that are subject to portfolio management. In this view, the large and successfully innovating firm can think of its technologies as assets that can be traded, and the management of that process is going to be of crucial strategic importance because it ties in with a whole range of other issues around what businesses and markets a firm should be in, what kind of competitive dynamics it wants to try to shape, and what kind of intellectual property protection should be used. This whole menu of strategic options makes markets for technology sound a little bit like a panacea, but they aren't, of course, right? In part because more strategic choice isn't necessarily good. There are pretty hard limits on managerial attention. But more importantly, it could just be really hard to trade technologies. All technologies can't be protected equally well, whether by secrecy or patents or some other process. And so sometimes the cost of imitating a technology can be very low, making it hard to disclose your innovation without compromising your ability to profit from it. This is known as Arrow's information paradox, by the way. Other technologies are hard to codify, and so they might be very costly to transfer, too costly perhaps to make it worthwhile if transfer is as difficult as development. Because markets for technology work best when replication is easy and imitation is hard, they don't always work particularly well. Also, the cost of contracting around a technology can just be really substantial because innovation, by its explorative and uncertain nature, can just be so hard to predict, right? So you may buy a technology for one purpose, realize that it does not work well for that, but that it works great for another, and then you want the contractual flexibility to allow this, at least if you're the buyer of technology, and that introduces a level of complexity. You will see that Aurora and his colleagues reference the idea of absorptive capacity quite a few times. And monitoring, they say, becomes a strategic imperative, and this is precisely dependent on the ability to recognize technologies of potential value in the surrounding environment, right? The key part of absorptive capacity. Certain technologies may not be obviously useful in a particular industry, or at least not equally obvious to everyone, because people possess different prior knowledge and therefore have different bases for evaluating. And this may be even more the case very early in a technology's life cycle, when essentially it'd be cheaper to acquire, perhaps. So striking the balance between how close and how distantly you search for technologies, for instance, is going to be very, very important. And that shapes the kind of in-house technological competencies that you will need in order to operate efficiently on the markets for technology. Moreover, depending on external sources of technology requires a firm to be able to successfully apply technologies that they have not themselves developed, and by implication, they might not understand as fully as the developer. And so this kind of translational competence may also be highly valuable in a way that it would not be in the absence of markets for technology. Okay. That seems, I think, like a really fitting treatment of markets for technology for now, at least. And so we're going to turn to the idea of broadcast search.